Yeah, the only reason you would need that is if you cite, well, if you're citing stuff from the wiki page, you want to give a proper citation, any format. And you can use Works Cited,
if
yeah.
If we reference stuff that we learned from the articles, or only
do objective quoting? You cite things to give credit, not just for quotes.
Okay.
So, yeah, if there's...
So
right, right. And so you can choose any format you want. Some people like to do it all in the footnote. Some people like to do a Works Cited.
Okay.
I'm easy. Yeah. Good question.
And we can put our names on it?
We don't want names on these. No.
Silk?
No. I'll make that explicit. Let's see if it's not already explicit. Let's take a look at our instructions. Thank you. This does require some effort because you guys were so well trained on this. I should add a little section. Good. I'll add a couple notes here on turning in the final draft, to at least to say it's anonymous. Yeah. Yeah. Good.
Do they use the saint names, or are we going to use the animal
names? Animal names work great. Let's just use animal names. Mm-hmm. So this, what I'd like you to do, and I guess I should make it more explicit, is, let's see, how did we do this? I'm getting better at this, so, but I don't know that I've done it yet for this. Yeah, wait. Here we go. You're really going to follow, these instructions here. So let's go ahead and just do this now. Some of you have your names in the headers of your document. Could you check and see if you have your name in the header of your document? Because some people just, you know, put it in there and figure, well, I'm always going to want my name on my paper. Fair enough, but not now. Okay. So I have to go through and like find your name. Sometimes it's hidden. Oh, look! We have some nice weather. Let's make sure we can appreciate that. Isn't that beautiful? Yeah, good question. Thanks. So, does that help? Yeah. Same thing you did on this last one. And okay. Other questions? Yeah. Okay. Yes, sir.
Then you emailed us to access our reviews, right? The reviews of our own paper.
I should have sent you that as an attachment, and then you've done the back evaluation. I didn't put an explicit back evaluation deadline. Can we say back evaluations are due tonight at midnight? Does that work?
Yeah.
You can tell we're making this up a bit as we go along. Okay. What's today? Oh, here it is.
Sixth.
Yeah, I'll tally those up and I'll send those out. It'll be like a quiz. I'm very excited about your paper. I've talked to a lot of you. You know, come in and kind of walk me through your paper. We've talked about arguments. I'm hoping to hear more about how the peer review comments work and see if they're really helpful. We'll have a little debriefing on that. Yeah, anything else? Did I mention this? There's this issue. There's this concept in writing advice that I may have mentioned. So stop me if I have. I'll just make brief mention of it. I've been bringing it up in some of the meetings with students about papers. The curse of knowledge is the idea that you don't need to take notes on this. The curse of knowledge is the idea that writers. One of the difficulties of writing is overcoming the knowledge that you've acquired in the process of preparing to write the paper. And the curse of knowledge is the idea that the fact that you know your topic really well is a kind of curse in trying to become a good writer, because what you have to do is communicate it to someone who's never seen it before, right? So even if you've read a bunch of papers on obligations to absolute poverty, you know, every reader has a problem of becoming as knowledgeable as the writer was about their topic. Does that make sense? So you have to overcome the curse of knowledge. That's a good problem to have. I mean, you acquire some knowledge. You've thought about this topic. Many of you have put in some good thinking time on it. So you have to, and this is something that every, this is something I confront as a writer too. I have to, oh, right, my reader isn't inside my head, right? My reader doesn't know what I've been thinking. That's the curse of knowledge. And you have to, whether you're a college writer or high school or college or, you know, you're writing for publication, the curse of knowledge is a huge problem. It just gets worse. You know. No, it sometimes gets better. Okay, so that's my little writing tip for the moment. Okay, we've got some interesting stuff to do, so if there's other questions about the paper, okay.
Was it supposed to be double-spaced?
I think it's easier to read double-spaced, yeah.
Okay.
Did I say that? I didn't say that?
Page
length. Yeah, oh no, don't give me 5 pages single-spaced, holy cow. Well, hey, let's talk about that right now. Yeah. It doesn't say double-spaced anywhere in here? I'm sorry. It's implicit. I'm gonna get real explicit about this. Problems. Yeah. Okay. I have to try to make things simpler at this point. I think the pedagogy's gotten complicated enough now. Okay.
But at least, well, now I know, and I'll fix it, and
whatever. Oh, by the way, I learned something about primates. Can I share that with you? It's absolutely irrelevant to our class. I'm so excited about it. I was going to write it to my colleagues, because it came up in a discussion. We were watching the game with a bunch of philosophers, you know, and I said, God, I'm reading this really cool book about how we used to be able to make vitamin C. You know, this is kind of, I read about food a lot. And so I was just so excited about this. And they were like, what? And I said, yeah. Apparently, I'm reading this medical anthropologist from UCLA who says, we used to be able to make vitamin C, so we didn't really need to eat fruit. And they're like, okay. How long ago was that? And I said, oh, just about 65 million years ago. So I was like, so they were just teasing me about it, because I was like, well, we weren't even people then. And I said, there were giant dinosaurs were going extinct then. And so I was embarrassed, because, you know, we're philosophers, we're supposed to, like, speak intelligibly. And so I said, oh, no, I think that was way before we were primates. And I just dug the hole deeper. Because as I learned, because I have this on my door, I have it on the wiki page, so there's these haplorbines and strepsirrhines. Sometimes they're called haplorhines and strepsirrhines. And so about 63 million years ago, they split, and they were primates. Both lines of those were primates. So I was dead wrong. In fact, I had no idea primates lived that long ago. Now, they didn't look like us or apes or monkeys. They looked like, you know, lemurs and lorises and tarsiers. So these are really ancient. These are our ancient descendants, which, you know, you sort of pick up. I mean, most people are okay saying, oh, yeah, the ape line, I get it, I'm over here. But the primates go, that's 18 million years ago. The primates go way back. And the cute detail is that the definition of a strepsirrhini is that it's a wet-nosed primate. And it's the word literally means twisted nose, and the haplorhines are the dry-nosed primates, something I never knew before. Isn't that fascinating? So we are dry-nosed primates. That's the conclusion of this little digression. And we are more related to tarsiers than you might imagine. We're all primates. I always thought of a tarsier as just some crazy little mammal that I'll never see. But anyway, so we're the dry-nosed primates. Can we get that clear now? Okay, anyway, sorry. That's a little follow-up from basketball viewing. Okay. I'm so glad I was able to share it with somebody. You're like a captive audience, so I guess I get to do that. All right, let's get to our work today, unless there's more thoughts about primates. Isn't that cool, though, that we used to be able to make vitamin C? Mm-hmm. We don't need fruit. All right, so today is a very different kind of class. I'm kind of excited about it, because you've read some professional philosophers already in the course, right? You've read some Singer, but he's writing for a pretty broad audience in the readings you've read. Here he's writing, Kora's Guard. We're going to meet two professional philosophers this week, writing in an academic vein. They're writing in an academic mode. And that makes the article a little harder to follow. Did you find it a little dry and dense? Right. Okay, fair enough. So this is a good week not to have quizzes for that reason and for lots of other reasons, right? So somebody suggested it, and I said, okay, yeah, right, why not? Also because I don't really expect you to come into class necessarily ready to just start talking about this article. Is that a reasonable assumption on my part? Okay, fine. So, but it's really cool. And today, both days, Kora's Guard and Singer. And what's cool about it is, in part, that it's a chance to really show you a little more about philosophical method, show you a little bit more about how a philosopher critically evaluates some research. So you have, let's start our notes then. And let's say that DeWall has given us a purely naturalistic account of morality, of the origin of morality, right? And by that I mean he thinks we can actually explain how morality emerges from our natural history, right? And it's also a gradualist account, right? Let's introduce that term. Kora's Guard uses the term because he thinks that modern morality is a series of gradual changes from primate morality, right? Does that make sense? Okay. So both of our philosophers this week are going to disagree with this claim. But they're not going to totally disagree with this claim. Kora's Guard comes closer to disagreeing with it, but we'll have to track that. So one question for your notes that I didn't get study question of is, to what extent are these philosophers agreeing with the DeWall's research? And then a separate question for your notes, to what extent do they agree with DeWall's conclusion? Because they're not going to deny that DeWall, well, it's going to get complicated. So you could agree that DeWall's made a very nice naturalistic, gradualistic account of morality, but you could, a very nice naturalistic account of moral emotions, but you might not agree with the gradualism. And so the main point for your notes is that both Kora's Guard, let's get her up here, right? Both Kora's Guard and Singer are going to disagree with naturalism, right? So let's see how they do it. Kora's Guard's going to be coming at it from a Kantian perspective. So let's see what she has to say about DeWall's view. And there's a lot of interesting things about philosophical method to illustrate. I'll try to get a list going for you. So let's just get some content on the table. The goal of today's class is to get you into small groups to evaluate her argument. That's kind of what a typical philosophical response would be, is say, oh, okay, we thought DeWall gave us, how many of you were kind of impressed with DeWall's account of primate morality? I mean, you found it interesting? Okay, good. I find it pretty persuasive. That's another reason I think it's neat to encounter a philosopher who is going to say, I don't know, I'm not so impressed. You know, I mean, that's sort of what Kora's Guard and Singer are going to tell us this week. So why not? How does philosophy give us a way to challenge the interpretation of a naturalistic account like this? Okay, so let's just get some content together, and I'll work from these notes. But you're trying to come up with some compressed notes. So there's two main parts of the argument, right? First, she responds to veneer theory, and then the longer part of her article is responding to DeWall's claim about gradualism. And she has a really neat argument for disagreeing with him, and so I want to present it succinctly and get you to see it, so stop me if it's not coming through. And then I'd like us to get into groups and kind of try to evaluate it, because I think that would be really cool. You come up with even more thoughts if you do that. So on veneer theory, here's what she says. It doesn't make sense to think about humans as self-interest maximizers. It's not coherent. That's her first point. Second point is that it doesn't make sense to talk about morality as constraining self-interest. Morality is much richer than that, and here she paints a very rich picture of morality as a way of life. It's a way of having, not just doing. It's a way of being and having. And she says that, boy, the idea, and she says this on 101, the idea of thinking about humans as fundamentally just interest maximizers just seems so wrongheaded to her. Let's see how she puts it. She says, when you imagine humans as self-interest maximizers, you have to imagine that someone's never spontaneously telling the truth in ordinary conversation. They're always calculating the effects of what they say to others. She said, you just have to imagine a really isolated creature. She said, that's not who we are. So it's incoherent to think about the problem of morality as constraining self-interest. And that's what the veneer theorist does, right? The veneer theorist thinks that nature makes us self-interest maximizers. So let's make sure you've got that picture in your notes, right? Remember the sphere? I can't even draw a sphere, but forget it. But the veneer theorist says nature makes us self-interest maximizers, and then morality comes along to control nature, to control that aspect of our nature. Korsgaard is not even agreeing with the premise of veneer theory. You get this? The premise is that we are, by nature, isolated self-interest maximizers. And she wants to say, no, that's not right. That's not who we are. And de Waal should agree with her, because de Waal would agree that we're a social species and all that. Okay? So let's just stop there. It's an interesting take, isn't it? She's saying, well, veneer theory's not that attractive. Let's ignore it. So she's arguing against it, but she's undermining it. She's kind of saying it's not even worth taking seriously. Does that set veneer theory to rest? Has she buried veneer theory? Does the veneer theorist have to be right in his or her belief that we're self-interest maximizers, or do they just have to believe that we're by nature self-interest maximizers? See, do you get veneer theory only by being right about us being self-interested, or could it be a theory that people actually hold just because they believe that we're self-interested? What do you think? This is the easy part. You want me to say it one more time? Okay. She's undermining veneer theory. She's saying it's not worth taking seriously. But my question is, does veneer theory only exist as a theory if it's true that we're self-interest maximizers? Or could veneer theory be a kind of ideology that people hold, which, whether it's true or false? Which one is Duvall's point? Is Duvall saying the veneer theorist is correct in saying that we're self-interested?
I think the veneer theorist is saying that we are self-interested regardless of whether or not we believe we are. So
right.
Independent of our position on the...
Right. But you can hold my point. I'll just make it as a point now. I think I didn't mean it to be that hard. Maybe I didn't say it well. My point simply, and you could make this in your notes, is that she may be right that veneer theory is incoherent, but it could still be a theory people hold, right? People hold incoherent theories. In fact, it is incoherent to say that evolution makes us self-interest maximizers. No anthropologist would say that. No good biologist would say that, right? We're social species. Clearly, our strategies involve cooperation and group behaviors. So I'll ask you in your groups to kind of evaluate how she comes out on this, but how you think she comes out on this. But I was impressed this time around that her criticism, even if her criticism is effective in saying that veneer theory is incoherent, it doesn't obviate the possibility that lots of people believe it, right? But I don't know. I'm kind of on board with the idea that veneer theory doesn't make sense, but I do think people did believe it. Thomas Huxley believed it. Darwin didn't believe it, right? You remember that opening chapter in Dwell. Okay, let's get on to the meat of the topic, because this is really what I want to focus on. So actually, a philosophical method here would be that sometimes philosophers undermine rather than refute, if you're keeping... We and by undermine, I mean, we sometimes philosophers just refuse to accept the premise of the argument. So they don't necessarily take on the argument the way it's offered. Sometimes they say, well, no, I don't even think that's even coherent. It's not one of the cruelest remarks a philosopher can make. And there was a historic example of this. A famous philosopher said to another philosopher in some argumentative context, that's not even wrong. You hear that? It's not even wrong. In other words, if we were just talking on the same premises, we'd say, well, are you right or are you wrong? Let's debate it. But philosophers are sometimes people who undermine even the basis for thinking about something, and they say, well, it's not even wrong. Okay, so the main argument that we need to track is the argument against gradualism. So let's start some notes on that. Remember, let's start by just recalling, you know, what is the argument for gradualism? Remember, we had this continuum up that started with empathy as contagion, right, where everybody just gets excited. Sorry, I keep my eye on the handwriting. And then over here we had cognitive empathy. And remember, flip back to your notes, just so I don't have to say this over again. And so gradualism is the idea that among different primates, we can observe increasingly, this is the point for your notes, we can observe increasingly complex forms of empathy. And that's the basis of DeWall's argument that human morality is just a more complex, a gradual progression of more complex forms of cognitive empathy. So for him, cognition does come into play at some point. It's not just that we get excited about each other's emotions. And you remember, it's, you know, targeted helping. There are all these steps in which, you know, you can sort of look at the components of that. And one of the big variables was the extent to which creatures have a theory of mind, right? Okay, so that's gradualism. That's DeWall's gradualism. So let's go through her argument. And I just want to take you through it, because it's not so easy. She has some speculations to make early on. She says, well, you know, we're probably more like apes than people think, but that's compatible with there being a deep discontinuity. So this is a major thing that Kantians think, and it's not surprising to find her saying it. She believes that, she says it a couple of funny ways. She says, it's almost as if we're damaged. We're different from, what does she mean by this? Could you take it, let's make sure you have the article handy here. She's writing about first few, here, I'll tell you where she is so you can follow along. So I want you to kind of remember your, page 104. Try to remember your reading experience here. Human beings seem psychologically damaged in ways that suggest some deep break with nature. What is she talking about there? Anybody? Gotta get you guys in the game. Maybe you had trouble getting that far, I don't know. But no? Okay, I can take you through it, that's okay. Okay, nobody? She's thinking basically that culture is not natural. That's not so unreasonable, right? So she's a little bit skeptical. Remember we were going to keep an eye on how much she's on board with the naturalistic account? So she agrees that we're a social species. She agrees that she's not disputing evolution. but she thinks, you know, there's something weird about human beings. At some point, we kind of separate ourselves from nature. That does sound kind of plausible, right? We seem to respond to each other in culture more than nature. In fact, environmentalism is the moment at which humans kind of wake up and kind of say, wow, maybe we should be paying a little more attention to how we interact with nature. So she's got this idea that there's a part of us that's maybe not part of this story. She's not, so make your note this way. She's not denying evolution. She's not casting any suspicion on what primatologists do. She's just not sure a wholly naturalistic account could really tell us about morality, because it seems like humans are in some ways bent. We're messed up. We're out of kilter in relation to nature, right? We live in heated houses. We've separated ourselves from nature. We build temples and cathedrals. Okay, so that's kind of her background attitudes. It's a very Kantian attitude. As you know, Kantians believe our moral obligations have nothing to do with our natural desires and inclinations. Remember that? She's going to give you a little summary of Kantianism in this article. But then she really digs in here, and this is the part. I think I'm going to get it organized a little better. When you see these notes that say, you know, next stage, okay, so this is the core of the argument. And I want to kind of represent that a little more schematically for you. Here's her criticism. This is at 105. She says, here's the mistake de Waal is doing. He's making the mistake of inferring intentions from behaviors. And humans have a categorically different way of experiencing intentionality. So de Waal is making the mistake of inferring intentions from behavior, and we need to kind of understand that better. So one thing philosophers do let's get the argument out, and then we'll talk about method. Okay. So she's going to distinguish a bunch of stages. Stage one is just any functional system. And functional systems can behave, they can, things like a thermostat. Here's your example, right? You're going to think this is funny, but philosophers actually have discussions about whether thermostats have beliefs. I thought it was silly, too. I was in graduate school, and this was kind of a new idea. Like, well, do thermostats have beliefs or intentional states? I don't think so. But for the sake of argument, you can imagine somebody asking, does the thermostat think it's hot in the room? Does the thermostat think it's cold? When it goes off, does the thermostat think it's just right? Crazy talk, right? Do you agree that's crazy talk? Okay, can we all agree with that? You guys, I'm provoking you here. I just want you to be able to know. But it's true that at the first level, so everybody agrees. So the point of your notes is everybody would agree that there's no intentionality there. But there is purpose. So functional systems have purpose. She has this great phrase, nothing before the mind. Remember that? She's going to make a lot of use out of that. Okay? And then the next stage is animals. Animals have movements, they have purposes. The animals are drawn to their food, they're drawn to their mates, but there's no reason to think the animal has anything in its head corresponding to an intention. The neurons are firing, you know, the metabolism is going, but the point is there's nothing before the animal's mind. We have no evidence to think there's anything in front of the animal's mind like, wow, there's some food. That's cool. It's pretty, she talks about it as instinct, pure instinct. Make sure that's in your notes, nothing before the mind. And what she means by that is they're not entertaining any thoughts about how to achieve. Well, that's the next level. So let's take more sophisticated animals. Let's say primates. I think that's who she has in mind for this next stage. There might be, we might be able to say that a primate has something before, has something, has an intention in mind. And it might make sense to talk about the animal choosing. They might have thoughts about means. So, you know, so a very clever animal might be trying to get at some food that's kind of behind an obstacle and might have different ways of getting at it, might use tools even. So there can be thoughts about means, but what isn't present at this stage is, these are just still instinctual affects. The animal only has, this is the point for your notes, the primate at this stage only has the drives that nature gave it. There's no choosing of the drives or desires or purposes, only a choosing about the means, okay? So she says, she's referring back to Dewall, right? This is a kind of a key moment. She says, Dewall thinks the Capuchin, remember the monkey fairness thing? That was really cool, right? Now we're going to throw cold water on. This is what philosophers do a lot. It's really sad. We're just like, we spoil the fun. That's our fun. So maybe the Capuchin isn't protesting unfairness. So back when we saw some of you watched the video, and there's a link to the video now if you want to see the actual image. It's really cool, you know. And at some point, the monkey that thinks something unfair happened just like knocks the whole tray over. It's like, it looks like moral indignation. See, that's her point. It looks to Dewall like the Capuchin monkey is protesting the unfairness, but maybe the monkey's just trying to get a grape. You see what I mean? The point for your notes is maybe we're overreading what the monkey has in its head at that moment. We're anthropomorphizing. We do this with our pets. We do this with our dog. We think our dogs have sophisticated. Oh, God, you want another good anecdote from the philosopher's game watching? I hadn't even thought to tell you about this. Wow, this was weird. So my colleague has a new German Shepherd. And the last time I went to the game, I accidentally put my a little glass of beer, just a little bit of beer. I put it on the ground. And the German Shepherd, like, snuck up behind me and started drinking my beer. And so this time, we noticed that this beautiful new German Shepherd was admiring me. That's what the host thought. He said, I think she has a crush on you. I said, no, dogs do not like me. It's not possible. So a few minutes later, I moved my beer to the floor, and she did the same thing. She was so busted. And she's just a young dog, so it was totally illegal. But anyway, so you can see in that situation, you see, I was just like, it's just a few months old. In that situation, isn't it tempting to say she remembered that she liked beer from 2 weeks ago, and she has an idea, beer, oh, just like you guys. So you see what I'm getting at? It's tempting to think there's a complex set of ideas going on in the head there. But the evidence might just be that she smelled the beer both times, and she has receptors in her nose that say, that's some sweet carbs here. Okay. I don't know. She wouldn't even be thinking that. It would just be this level. Pure. She just has these instincts. Somehow beer triggers it, so she does it. Okay, so where are we? Here's the argument. You need to represent this schematically, because the argument against gradualism gets made once you've got a difference that isn't gradual, right? So that's kind of the argument strategy. It's not that complicated, right? If somebody thinks something's gradual, the way you argue against it is to say, well, nope, this step is huge, and we're the only ones who do it. Okay, so let's see what she's got, because she's got a really good Kantian point here. at this stage, we're giving justifications. That's a categorically different thing than non-human animals do, even our nearest cousins. At this stage, we're asking this question. Let's dilate on this question for a minute. Is wanting this thing a good reason for pursuing it? So you know, read off the notes with me here. This is what she's. This is the core of our argument, and this is where the Kantianism comes out. We choose not only means to ends, but ends themselves. So she reminds you about Kant's deontology. You know, to determine whether there's a justification for something, you have to formulate the maxim, try to imagine as universal law, right? And the point is that, this is the point for your notes really, is that only humans choose ends as well as means. We're the only ones, okay, I'll let you write that. Only humans choose ends as well as means. We're the only ones who ask, is this the end I should be trying to achieve? Is this a good end? Is wanting this a good reason for pursuing it? All the other, you know, everything else is just, it's all locked in. We're the only ones who have, use the word freedom here, we're the only ones who have the mental capacities that allow us the freedom to ask whether the ends given to us by nature, the desires and instincts given to us by nature, are the ones we ought to choose in a particular case. And that's where you get real morality, right? Some thoughts, some reactions, thoughts on this? We don't have to. I'm just trying to make sure I'm not missing that. How about understanding? Do you see why she thinks she's really found a dramatic difference here? Let's take a minute. I want to get some nonverbal on this. Yep, Nick.
So if I have food for my dog and I sit it with the dog and see it, the dog is trained to not eat until I say go.
Good.
Was she just chalked that up to conditioning?
Yeah. Yeah, you think your dog's thinking, okay, he's said it's okay, now I can choose that end. Right. Do you think your dog is really doing all that? Because after all, they're training this dog that I was talking about, you know. You should see how it greets visitors. Jeez, we're still working on that. You know. So yeah, I mean, that's a good question, yeah. She would say no. It's totally behavioral. You know, and a slight digression, philosophers used to think, and certainly philosophers in Kant's day still thought, for the most part, that humans, that non-human animals were like clocks. They were just, it was all mechanistic. And this is the important part, we are not. In other words, we are free from, we're somehow independent from nature. Remember that comment early on about how we're a little damaged, we're not completely in tune with nature. Human culture takes us out of nature. That's what she's thinking. She's thinking, wow, we're the ones who have separated ourselves from having pre-programmed instinctual goals. And there is, do you feel it? She has a really good point here. Do you feel it? You know, I spend time, you know, in nature, and the animals never seem to be choosing their goals. They just seem to be choosing the means, right? You getting this? Good. I'm getting some nonverbal. That's great. Okay. So now we have a problem. I mean, let's see. We're almost ready for small group work. I mean, she's certainly shown us something that plausibly argues against gradualism. But there aren't complete victories or losses here. I mean, this is a really complicated problem. One of the things I want you... So here's the prompt for small group work, and I think we're ready to do it. Talk a little bit about what she thinks is this distinctive step. If you get to the page, if you take a minute just to enrich your discussion, if you get to page 117, there's a nice statement about this. It's really kind of ennobling. I mean, Kantian has a really nice song to play here. I mean that seriously, like a philosophical move. And isn't a small difference, that ability to be motivated by an ought? It does represent what Dewall calls a saltatory change. That means a change that leads to big changes. A form of life governed, this is page 117, a form of life governed by principles and values is a very different thing from a form of life governed by instinct, desire, and emotion. Even a very intelligent, sociable form of life governed by instinct, desire, and emotion. Kant's story about the man deciding to face death rather than bear false witness, do you remember that? Man's in a position, he's being told to bear false witness, and he's by the king, and he's going to be killed if he doesn't. That's the stuff of high moral drama. That's something we do because we can choose ends, you know, but we have ideas about what we ought to do and to be like, and we're constantly trying to live up to them. Apes don't live that way. We struggle to be honest and courteous and responsible and brave. Even if apes are occasionally courteous or responsible or brave, it's not because they think they should be. That's kind of an interesting comment. Even as primitive a phenomena as a teenager's effort to be cool is a manifestation of the human tendency to live a life guided by ideals rather than merely driven by impulses and desires. So she thinks she's really done the job. Maybe she has. One thing I'd like you to consider in groups is has she given you a reason? How strong a conclusion can you draw for her? Has she given you a reason to kind of discount all of the earlier stages as being relevant to morality? Has she given, you know, think about Haidt. We don't just have Duvall on the table. You guys have also been reading Jonathan Haidt, which has more moral psychology in it. Has she given us a reason to pay less attention to what Haidt is telling us? Because Haidt thinks these moral emotions are definitely operative in contemporary morality. But remember, she's going to agree with Singer. Remember, Singer's already told us he thinks those emotions are often a problem. We have to kind of overcome them because they lead us to prefer people in our neighborhood versus people we could help who are far away. Okay? So in your small groups, ask yourselves, what has Korsgaard shown? Has she shown that Duvall's theories totally wrong, needs to be modified? Can you save gradualism while still acknowledging what you think is good in her argument? So the game's not over, is my point, and you need to kind of hash it out. And so try to ask yourselves that try to figure out whether what you need to accept from her argument, because I think there's some powerful points here, and what its actual effect is on Duvall's gradualism. And take some notes. I'd like you to come back with some questions, comments, some ideas to express that. Okay? Let's do this in groups. This could take 10 minutes easily or a couple of days. Let's see what we got. So I'd like to kind of see what came out of your groups. I was asking you to evaluate her critique and see if it really does as much work as she thinks it does. Maybe even more, but maybe it does less. Maybe she has. So what's the effect of her argument on Duvall's gradualism? So what do we got? What came out of your groups? Yeah, please.
I think collectively when we were talking about the stages, is that we thought it kind of assumes a lot. She refutes the fact that Duvall believes in more intentionality, and she thinks it's just instinctual, but there's no real way to either prove you're right or wrong, because you can't really go inside and like the dog. That made me think of, I wish that she had brought in maybe more biological examples,
right,
to get more evidence either against this point or for
this. Right. Philosophers sometimes don't like to do that. Sometimes philosophers just like to. It's the concepts that almost does it. But she is appealing to something intuitive, which is that if dogs were really choosing different purposes in their life, we would notice. I think it'd be weird, wouldn't it? I mean, suddenly the dogs wouldn't just be interested in the stuff that they seem to always do. So yeah, it's a good point. Very good thing to come out of your group. Yeah, others. Yeah, and biology might not have made, there might have been some counter evidence there from the record, biological record. Yeah. What else? How many of you think, did some of your groups think, yeah, she did a pretty good job? This is what I think is kind of missing in a primate-based account of morality, right? I mean, we are a lot more complicated than primates, so don't be reluctant to stand up for that and say, well, yeah, I've been wondering when we were going to get to things beyond, like, you know, helping. You remember the primate help, targeted helping, right? What else came out of groups? I mean, there were some insights. Did any of you, maybe some of you agreed with, about some of her insights. I think it is an insight that it's significant that we choose ends, that we live by ideals. I think that's something that I don't see dogs and primates doing. And I don't think you could predict human culture from nature. I mean, I think we're better at predicting non-human animals' behavior than humans, because human culture just seems to open up this wild card. Like, what direction is it going to go? Nobody would have predicted that, you know, in ancient Greece, that, you know, 2,000 years later, people would have invented human rights. Where is that? So some people say that learning and energy capture explain where humans got off the nature train and started to control. Other people would say CRISPR, and some of you know about CRISPR, this really interesting but scary gene editing technology. We could be taking our destiny in our own hands. We could actually be editing our genome and turning ourselves into something that nature never would have created. Weird. Okay. Other thoughts? So on this list, while you guys were working, I was thinking, well, you know, I like continua. So I was thinking, well, what's the strongest implication from Korsgaard's argument for Dewall? And so maybe this is useful for your notes. I mean, the strongest would be to say, Dewall's dead wrong. You gotta stop reading him. Take him out of the course. He's not telling us anything about morality, right? Is anybody moving? Feel free to identify with that. Is that, because you could be feeling, if you're really feeling Korsgaard's argument, you could be thinking, you know, morality isn't really so much part of our evolved nature. That's okay. That's a very legitimate position. It doesn't mean you're denying evolution or anything. It just means, like a lot of things, we don't find evidence of this human activity in nature. Like we don't find evidence of basketball in nature, you know. So you could say, wow, she's really hit a home run here. Sorry, I'm mixing my sport metaphors. You know, she's dead wrong. He's dead wrong. Further down the continuum toward, you know, maybe her argument doesn't really defeat gradualism. Maybe Dewall's right about emotions, but he's missing a crucial part of human morality. You see how that would be a crucial step or a crucial difference? And a lot of this has to do with whether you think the emotions are still with us in accounting for morality. That's a big question in this course, a big question in moral theorizing today. So a little further down, you could say, well, yeah, intentionality is a big step. Sure, she's got an insight there. You know, choosing ends, which comes about from intentionality, real full-fledged intentionality, where you can not only hold things before your mind, but ask that really powerful question, is this desire I have a good reason for acting on that end, moving toward that end? So you could say, yeah, of course God has an insight. It's a big step, but it doesn't mean all the rest is irrelevant. It doesn't mean that the empathetic emotions don't tell us something about sophisticated empathy, and that's still important to us. Notice that Korsgaard leaves open the question of how important moral sentiments are at the end of the day. You could see, if you're a really serious Kantian, you know, they're usually what you have to overcome to do your duty. Right, but if you're a naturalist like Haidt and Dewall, they're part of the machinery for getting morality to happen in social groups. And if we ever lose empathy, if we ever lose the capacity to be empathetic, it'll hurt our ability to cooperate as groups. That sounds plausible too, right? Okay, a little further down, right? That's not conformism. Servitude. Maybe intentions and ideals still serve natural imperatives. I'm going to explain what I mean by that, but go ahead and get into your notes. she makes it sound like the ability to choose ends takes us completely out of our evolved imperatives, our natural imperatives. What are those imperatives? For a social species, it's to be a member in good standing of a group and contributing by cooperating to the group's goals to flourish, right? So maybe she kind of assumes that, wow, this freedom that we have to choose our ends, woof, takes us out of nature, right? Now we can make up any kind of ideals we want. But, you know, Dewall could come back and say, yeah, we're pretty fancy. We got things like human rights. But notice that these ideals, these moral ideals that primates can never even imagine, they're still ultimately ideals about human flourishing, aren't they? They're still ultimately in the service. This is the key idea, connecting it to evolution. They're still ideals that we are, that are in the service of human flourishing. So even if, so let's think about that more concretely. So this would be a way of saying, wow, she's absolutely right. This is crazy stuff we do. We choose ends. We can represent things to ourselves in sophisticated ways. But you know what? All that might still be going to work to satisfy the imperatives of nature, which are for us to thrive. And so why would you advocate human rights? Well, you might think human societies thrive better. They're happier. They're more productive. There's less war. There's more, you know, all kinds of good stuff. So if you're here, then Dewall doesn't have a whole lot to worry about, does he? He just has to modify he just has to agree that, of course, by the time we get to the United Nations and human rights, you know, sure, we're off the map. But he doesn't have to deny that, does he? See, in philosophy, a lot of times what we're trying to figure out, we're trying to use competing arguments to figure out what's the significance of the underlying data. What point does it still make? That's why, you know, I've identified this as an implication. Okay, what do you think, guys? This is kind of not an easy week for discussion, but I really want to make sure you guys are up, you know, tracking this and feel like you're on it. So just take a minute and see if you got it. I didn't get up. You guys were, it was a vigorous discussion. Something was being talked about in the group. So if there's anything else from that you want to bring forward, there's plenty of time. We can still break early, but there's plenty of time. Okay, are you good? All right, great. I'll see you next time.